Hi folks, hope everyone's well. This is Jim Carroll saying hello and welcome you to the latest Bantercast, the weekly podcast from the team behind the Banter series of talks and events. At Banter, we put on events in spaces and venues of all sizes up and down the country where people tell stories, talk about themselves, talk about various topics and teams, and we record what happens in the room, and then a few weeks later or a few months later, we podcast the results. It's become a tradition at Banter for us to head to Dingle in County Kerry every December for the Other Voices Festival. There, we take over a room in a pub called Foxy John's. You can also buy hardware in our bicycle there, though we haven't done either to date. We light a fire in the back room and we invite a bunch of interesting people to come along and tell us some stories. Our guest today is Dublin-born neurologist Dr. Susanna Sullivan. She's the author of It's All in Your Head, a book of tales from the front line of psychosomatic illnesses, which won the Wellcome Book Prize in 2016. Psychosomatic illnesses, are where your body acts if it's sick but there isn't anything wrong, are common, misunderstood, yet rarely discussed, according to Suzanne. She tells us some stories today about some of the extreme cases she has treated and what may be behind him. Hi folks, welcome back to Banter here at Foxy John's. Hope you're all having a good time. We've had two interviews so far, so this is the third one, so that shows I can add up. Welcome. This woman here wrote a book that Molly and Mary had recommended to me, called "It's All in Your Head: True Stories of Imaginary Illness." And I was just thinking to myself, okay, this sounds interesting. And then I started reading it. It's pretty compelling. So, please, big round of applause. Big welcome to Dr. Susanna Sullivan. I know. I just said to you that we'd start in a certain way, but like, we'll leave that aside. I'm curious about, like, you know, you're a neurologist. You've probably got a heavy practice in London. Yeah. You're working with an awful lot of case studies. Where did you find the time to write, and when did you begin writing?
Actually, I think kind of most people kind of assume that I wrote this book sort of straight from having never written at all. But actually, writing was sort of a hobby that I did to get myself out of work at times. And then I was talking to someone about my work, and they just said, "You've got to write about that," basically. So I had been writing for a while purely for my own pleasure. And then someone suggested I write about my work, which I found I was very resistant to at the beginning, because it's incredibly, I don't know if anyone here has written or is writing a book, but it's incredibly exposing and very frightening at the start. So I was a little reluctant, but you know, I see people who have things wrong with them, which quite frankly are incredibly common, but nobody's ever heard of it. This is not what you asked me, but I do tend to take off on my own. Sorry about that.
It's great.
But basically, you know, so I work as a neurologist, and my main job when I was appointed as a consultant was to look after people who had seizures. And I thought that I would spend my whole time essentially treating people for epilepsy, which is the main cause for seizures. And my job was to admit people to hospital who had the worst kind of seizures. So most people with epilepsy, you put them on tablets and most of them get better. The ones who don't get better, you bring them into hospital, you video them having seizures to try and figure out why they're not getting better. And when I took the job of videoing people with seizures, I thought I'd spend a lot of time looking after people with epilepsy. What actually happened was that in the first year of practice, 70% of people that I saw were not getting better on epilepsy treatment because they didn't have epilepsy. What they had was a thing called, medically we call them dissociative seizures, but you would know them perhaps as hysterical seizures or hysteria. So these people were having seizures for purely psychological reasons and not because they had any brain disease at all. Now this is incredibly common, and yet I was constantly meeting people and telling them, "I'm sorry, you don't have epilepsy, you have this other thing," and no one had ever heard of it. And I thought, how could this be so common to doctors and to neurologists in particular? And no one else has ever heard of it. So I kind of got to a point where I was constantly meeting this shock and surprise all the time. And it seemed to make sense then to write about it and just publicize. Not only I see people with seizures very often, but these sort of physical manifestations of psychological things are ubiquitous, and they come in any form. So to a neurologist, they could be paralysis, blindness, memory loss, deafness, anything you can imagine. But to other sort of medical specialists, it's palpitations or sort of shortness of breath or any sort of symptom you can imagine. So this is unbelievably common, and it just felt like it needed to be. The story needs to be told.
Right. When you studied in Trinity, Suzanne, I mean,
I did.
What did? What was your? Where did you think you were going? It was going to lead you to?
Well, I mean, Trinity, my medical education in Ireland was absolutely fantastic, and I became a neurologist because I was spectacularly inspired by the neurologist I worked with. I mean, they were really passionate about their subject. But it's an interesting thing about medical training, and this doesn't refer at all necessarily to Trinity, to all medical schools, is that, you know, we spend our whole time looking for diseases and doing tests looking for diseases and worrying about missing diseases. And we do a lot of scans and blood pressure monitorings and so forth, because basically there's terrible recriminations come with missing diseases. So if I thought I was going anywhere, I thought I was going to spend the rest of my life treating brain diseases. The truth of the matter is, one third of people who go and see their doctor for any reason don't have a disease. And medical training, as brilliant as it was at Trinity, and I absolutely think it's wonderful, didn't ever cover that. So about a third of patients who go and see the doctor's probably thinking, you know, shit, well, what am I going to do with her? I never learned about this. No one gave me a strategy for dealing with this.
Do you think that's one of the reasons then why people end up being diagnosed? Because you need to put the patient into a box.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It's not that we want to put people in a box. People want to be put in a box, quite frankly. There's kind of a mutual kind of little kind of arrangement between us. People want a label. And it feels better for me to be able to say to a patient, you have this, because they're delighted to have an explanation for what's wrong with them. So it's a kind of I think we're all in a bit of a collaboration, which is actually quite harmful, basically. Yeah. Because the minute we're medicalizing everything that happens to our bodies. And the minute you medicalize something, you turn it into a chronic problem that somebody will have for the rest of their life. Whereas a lot of things that happen don't necessarily have a disease basis or don't have to be medicalized.
Yeah, you said there, like, I mean, when you tell the patient, okay, you've got disease X, they're delighted. There are the people who are delighted as well, Suzanne. This come across in your book again and again, you know, is the family, the people who are around them. And sometimes I kind of felt from reading the book, the book is divided, for those who haven't read it, the book is basically, I think it's 7 or 8 different kind of like case studies. And the case studies are anonymized. You give each person a different name, and you talk about like where you met the person, you talk about like what conditions they were in, what symptoms they were reporting. But I kind of felt that sometimes it was the people around the patient that were as kind of much looking for the one true answer as anyone else.
I think basically when you're dealing with, so I mean, what the book is about is people with psychosomatic conditions. So people have a variety of different neurological disabilities that are happening for psychological reasons. So some of the people, one woman is blind, somebody else has multiple different disabilities, seizures, paralysis, she self-catheterizes. So these are people with a whole bunch of really serious physical disabilities for psychological reasons. And it can work. Trying to get a diagnosis across to people and trying to make people better has a number of different sort of minefields in it, because sometimes the families are delighted that somebody has given an explanation that they can understand and which has potentially a way forward. But sometimes the families really stand in the way of the diagnosis. So if you say to a 20-year-old girl that you think her seizures have a psychological rather than a physical cause, rather than a disease-related cause, I should say, sometimes the person who's suffering with the seizures can actually take that on board quite easily and kind of has a sense that that's what it was. But actually their family will resist the diagnosis, because the minute you say somebody's 20-year-old has essentially hysteria or hysterical seizures, that comes with a lot of issues for the family. They're saying, well, why does my loved one have it? Is it something to do with me? Is it something I did? Usually it isn't at all, but unfortunately it has connotations beyond the actual sufferer, which can mean the whole family find it really difficult.
Yeah. How quick, like, you know, obviously each case differs. How quickly can you kind of like suss when a patient comes into you, when a patient's been referred to you, that it's someone who's basically the situation you just described, where it's psychological as opposed to physical?
I mean, the thing about neurology is that it's a very sort of, you can really sort of tell the difference. I think other specialties are different. But in neurology, if someone has weakness in their legs, for example, because they have a spinal cord disease, versus weakness in their legs for a psychological reason, there are really big differences between those things. Because first of all, there's a pattern of weakness is different. Secondly, you know, there's a really big kind of imbalance between what we call objective signs. Your reflexes are your reflexes. They go through your spine, not through your brain, so they don't not influenced by anything you're doing. So there's objective things and there's subjective things. And in someone who has paralysis, for example, for a psychological rather than a disease-related reason, there is usually quite a big difference. So for neurologists, it's actually usually at the first meeting, we would strongly suspect the diagnosis. However, I think it's like super important that I emphasize it's not a diagnosis we make lightly. You know, it shouldn't be. So you might, we'll always, as a doctor, suspect something at the first meeting. But the point is that your suspicions are just your suspicions, and then you need to make sure you've listened to the person properly, examined them properly, and investigated them properly. So I would say there's a very big difference, for example, between seizures that are, I keep using the word hysterical, but I'm using it in the old-fashioned way. I just need it to be understood that I'm talking about seizures that have a psychological reason, whereas a lot of our medical terminology now, I think, is used to hide what we're really talking about. So I could talk to you about dissociative seizures, and you'd all leave the room thinking, well, they sound terrible, but what the hell are they, basically? So I think there's a big difference between these things, but it's a diagnosis you make after careful consideration. It's not something that you make lightly.
Okay, let's go to kind of, like, I suppose some of the cases, you know, in the book. I mean, there's a woman patient you call Camilla, for example. Yeah. You know, talk a little bit about her.
Yeah, she was a woman who, like, she's a very, very successful woman, extremely hardworking, extremely successful in her career. And she was at a meeting on one occasion when she suddenly started having seizures. She saw some doctors. She was diagnosed with epilepsy. She was put on epilepsy treatment. She didn't get any better. When people don't get better, they get referred to an epilepsy specialist, which is what I am. And what we do then is we video her seizures and discover that they are these dissociative seizures or hysterical seizures. Now, that was a very difficult diagnosis for Camilla to take, because there was immediate feeling was, well, I'm not that sort of person. I'm not a worrier. I'm successful. I'm not anxious. I'm not depressed. But this isn't anxiety. This isn't depression. So you don't have to be a particular kind of person, and you don't have to have any psychological symptoms at all. The seizures are there instead of the psychological symptoms. So sometimes you have them precisely because you can't feel whatever emotion is bringing them on in the first instance. So for a long time, there was, you know, we absolutely certain what was wrong with Camilla, because we had videoed her seizures with a brainwave tracing that meant in an epileptic seizures, your brainwaves just go crazy, basically, in a bizarre electrical pattern. And in these kind of seizures, your brain just shows a normal waking pattern as if you were completely conscious. So there was no question about the diagnosis, but there was a real problem with accepting it in the context of there being no obvious trigger.
Right. Go back to what you just said there, like, son. You said, like, I mean, the brain waves. If in an epileptic seizure, like you said, they go haywire. Yeah. So when you turn around to Camilla and you show her the scans, you go, this is what would happen if it was epileptic. This is your situation.
Yeah, we say that to people, but they still have great difficulty accepting. You know, the brain waves are saying you're awake, but you don't feel awake. Imagine how you would respond to that. You're like, well, you know, I am unconscious, but you're telling me my brainwave shows a normal waking pattern. And then I usually will say to people, well, this happens to us in little ways. Dissociation happens to us all in little ways all the time. So this is when you're reading a book and you've read the whole page of the book and you get to the bottom of the page of the book and you haven't got a clue what it said. Or you're paying it complete attention to the news, you think, but you haven't taken anything in. That's dissociation, where our mind wanders off somewhere, but we're actually sitting there awake, appearing to be engaged in an activity. That's a normal thing. I don't know why or how exactly it happens, but it can be more exaggerated in other people and produce things like seizures. So it's just really trying to, I think very often a lot of these psychosomatic things are actually exaggerations of normal physiological things. So it's really trying to make people understand that. And also, if we see them as exaggerations of normal physiological things, we can better understand that it's not deliberate, because that's always the other problem. You know, it's like people always say, well, you think I'm doing it on purpose, or I could stop it if I wanted, etc. And then I say to people, well, I'm sitting here, I'm not used to talking to a crowd of people. My heart's going at about 150 beats per minute. And basically, I am not doing that on purpose, and I could not stop it if I wanted to. It is a uncontrollable physical thing that is happening to me for a purely psychological reason. My heart speed has doubled. But I don't have a heart disease. And that's what these seizures like as well. They're a physical thing. They're real. They're not in your control. And the reality of them is important to kind of express. The bottom line with Camilla was that I often find that there's different reasons these things can happen. And I often find that the most useful thing is to really get down to what were you actually doing the very first one? Because often the first one's the important one, and all the other ones are just manifestations of kind of things getting worse, and they're not necessarily relevant to the cause. And for a long time, Camilla maintained that her first collapse was in this particular meeting, until, in, you know, we'd had a discussion about it 100 times. And eventually her husband said, well, you did collapse one time before. And she had actually collapsed when there was a horrible accident. She lost a child, actually. And basically, she had collapsed at that moment, but she knew this horrible tragedy had happened to her. She felt she had dealt, it wasn't that she was in denial or she'd forgotten any of this. It was just she'd somehow she'd found a psychological way to separate the tragedy from her current life, which it was now many years later. But unfortunately, I think when really tragic things happen to us, you know, burying them isn't always the healthiest thing, and things can come out as physical symptoms. Although I would like to emphasise at this point, I think it's really important that people realise that things like hysterical symptoms don't just happen because you've had a horrible tragedy. They absolutely happen because you've had a horrible tragedy, but they happen for a million other much more innocent reasons. So another common thing with seizures would be that you get someone who, and in London, people are always fainting on the underground because it's so packed. And basically, you get someone fainting on the underground, and then they go back in the underground the next time, and they think, oh my God, yeah, I hope I don't faint on the underground again. And then you get into this kind of thought pattern of fear and avoidance, where nothing psychologically awful happened to you at all, but you just had a minor thing happen to you, and now you're having difficulty adjusting to it, and you're worrying, and the more you worry, the more something else happens. And that's just an important point, because going back to Freud dealt a lot with hysterical symptoms, and he talked about everything kind of dated back to a trauma, and if you could uncover the trauma, then the symptoms would melt away. But that led to a situation in which doctors were constantly saying to patients who had psychosomatic problems, what's the trauma, what's the trauma? Mm. The patient's going, there was no trauma, and it's just really an ugly antagonistic situation between patient and doctor. And the truth is, lots of time there is no trauma. I mean, in the book I tell about my own, a psychosomatic disorder, I should say, is where you have an actual disability from psychosomatic. We all get psychosomatic symptoms like the palpitations or the shaky hands. But I once injured my foot. I broke a bone in my foot, and it transpired I'm a very bad patient, because I expected when the cast came off my foot that I'd be doing the kind of the fling or whatever like 2 days later. And when I was still kind of hobbling around, I was like, well, that's not normal, you know. And the more I hobbled, the more I thought, you know, oh my God, that bone has not knit together properly. And the more I thought the bone hadn't knit together properly, the more I couldn't walk on my foot, until eventually I went to my doctor and I said I thought that it hadn't healed properly. And I limped down to the doctor, and basically he sent me straight for an x-ray. The x-ray was absolutely fine, and I skipped home, basically. So, you know, but the point being that sometimes these disorders can happen. You don't have to be a particular kind of person. You just have to worry about something and potentially pay too much attention to it.
Mm.
And we all do that from time to time, and that's all right, because then if the doctor says you're fine and you accept the reassurance, sure, that's normal. We all do that. The problem is when we don't accept the reassurance, and then things get out of control.
Okay, before you get on to that, because I want to bring in the honourable Dr. Google into proceedings. But yeah, like, let's talk about Camilla. Let's talk about Camilla then. Yeah. When you kind of like outlined to her what was going on, and the fact that okay, it's basically back to the loss of that child. Did she accept it, or did it take her time to accept it?
No, she did accept it. I think once she kind of she struggled to accept the diagnosis in the first instance. But I think once her husband sort of started making this connection for her, it helped her to sort of make the connection. And, you know, in quite a Freudian way, she did actually start getting better quite soon after that. So in her case, she was actually very accepting. But a large proportion of people never accept this. And then what happens is they go to another doctor and another doctor and another doctor. And unfortunately, I hate to tell you, but if you want to have a particular disease, if I wanted today to have epilepsy, if I sought enough medical opinions, I would eventually find a doctor who told me I had it, especially as I got more practiced in the history just from being asked questions and things. So the more doctors you go to, you will eventually, they'll find something wrong with you if you look hard enough. So over-medicalisation is actually quite a dangerous thing in the 21st century.
I suppose I'm staggered by what you just said there. Not for the fact that this is how someone can actually do it, but for the fact that someone would want to do it.
Well, no one wants to do it, but if you... so, and that's an important point, is it's not a want. It's basically, you know, if you have a crippling symptom and your doctor says they can't find a physical disease-related explanation for it, and you aren't able to fully accept that reassurance, then people will go on a relentless search for the disease to explain their symptoms. Mm. And unfortunately, because our tests are so sophisticated now, our medical investigations, if you go to enough doctors, you will eventually be given a diagnosis.
Okay, we mentioned Dr. Google there, you know, and the fact that people have this kind of like tendency now to just, I suppose, Google what symptoms they have and suddenly they're having a stroke.
Yeah, well, you know what? I'm often asked about the internet and do I think it's made it worse? It so has not made it worse. Like, you know, at the end of the 19th century, there was an absolute plague of psychosomatic disorders. And that was just through word of mouth, basically. And what they used to say back then was it was the fast pace of life. Sure, 100 years later, we're saying exactly the same thing. So I think we're not very original. I think that what Google basically has done is it's changed the language people use. So 50 years ago, if you had some kind of symptom, you would attribute it based on something you read in the newspaper or something your neighbour said over the fence. So the attributions were less sophisticated, perhaps. Whereas now, obviously, you can go to Google and you can have a more sophisticated language for your symptoms and more sophisticated diagnosis. But the symptoms are exactly the same as they were ever.
Okay. So, like, I mean, when you get a patient coming into you, you know, and they're talking in a way that you know that they've kind of consulted the internet, you know, do they, I suppose, kind of... what's the word I'm looking for? Kind of like ascribe a certain level of authority to what they found online that they mightn't necessarily accept in a doctor's surgery?
Well, do you know what? It's not online. I would often have people say to me, you know, something, someone in the street, a nurse or a doctor or a medical person in the street saw my seizure and said it was definitely epileptic. And I just don't know what to say to that. I want to say, you're in an epilepsy clinic. What are you talking about, the man in the street? So I think people will sort of cling to the opinion if you get, and I would often see people who've got, you know, six doctors told them they didn't have something and one doctor told them they did. And that's the doctor they want to believe. Whereas obviously you want to believe the majority opinion, not the not the minority.
It reminds me kind of the moment. Obviously, people are talking a lot about fake news and how fake news contributed to Trump's victory in the United States. And like, fake news is what basically is widespread because it's what people want to believe. Yeah, you know, I think that's something we can't get around.
Yeah, exactly. And newspapers and TV reports and things. I mean, they do influence, again, not the frequency or severity of this, but the shape of it. And it's sort of, you know. To be honest, none of us here are above it. If, you know, the way it works is, you know, you hear that the water supply in Foxy John's is contaminated with a vomiting bug. Half of us will.
She's just made that up. She's just made that up. For the purpose of those listening on the podcast, Dr. Suzanne Sullivan just made that up.
It doesn't take long for us to start searching our bodies for those symptoms, you know. So none of us are above it. It's the question is, you know, the difference between a psychosomatic symptom and a disorder. We all get the symptoms from time to time. You know, it's just completely normal. It's just whether it turns into a disability and then it's a problem.
You mentioned Freud earlier on. I mean, this is something that this isn't a new development. This has been around, sir. Like, I mean, ancient Greeks were talking about this.
Oh yeah, I mean the term hysteria. Well, I mean, before we had modern medicine, before we had modern understanding of anatomy and physiology, anything could be psychosomatic or anything could be a disease, you know. So it's not until you really hit modern times where we're able to kind of understand anatomy and physiology and pathology that we could really distinguish different things. But the term hysteria was initially coined. Hystera is the Greek for womb, and hysteria was a wandering womb. So it was believed that a womb traveled around our bodies causing illness or disease. So if it travelled up into my chest, I could get chest pain, or up into my head, I would get seizures. So that's sort of where the term hysteria comes from. But there was a real heyday for it in the end of the 19th century in France with a neurologist called Charcot, who basically was a person who delineated incredible number of neurological diseases. He found the lesions in multiple sclerosis. He described loads of muscle disorders, but he was hugely interested in hysteria and was the first person to scientifically study it. An interesting thing happened, though, with his scientific study, or two interesting things. First is he created a bit of a plague of hysteria by making it a sort of an illness that people were taking seriously, it actually increased in frequency. But he also interested Freud. Freud was a huge fan of Charcot, and then Freud became the next sort of guru of hysteria, and wrote his book Studies in Hysteria, which is loads of case histories, again, just looking at hysterical cases. But I think Freud was brilliant because he brought attention to the problem, but he also sort of, some of his theories were not correct and caused problems also. You know, with regards to thinking that everybody who has hysterical symptoms has been sexually abused, well, that, you know, he realized eventually that was impossible, but to a certain degree some of that stuck, and that caused some problems for people with the diagnosis.
I mean, there are several kind of, I suppose, interesting statistics that you outline in the book, and one of them is that 70% of patients who present with inexplicable conditions are female.
Yes, it is. I mean, this was something I'll be honest, I completely resisted this at the beginning, being female myself, which, you know, and I think there is an element, right, in which male doctors diagnose psychosomatic disorders in women more readily than they do in men, basically. And I think it's interesting to look at Freud and Charcot's cases, because they both wrote extensively about their cases, and they've got really famous patients. They're all women. They had male patients, they just didn't write about them. So there's definitely a kind of a fondness for diagnosing psychosomatic disorders in women that influences the statistics. However, I am a woman, and you know, more of my patients are women also. So this is a disorder which is more likely to happen to women. I think that basically men and women suffer differently. You know, as I'm sure you all know, you know, there's a very high suicide rate amongst young men, for example. Again, I don't want to start running down men, but they drink more and they're more likely to be aggressive. And I think we all get those stresses and things out differently. So it does tend to be a disorder which is more likely to affect women, but it's also a disorder that people are more willing to diagnose in women. It's definitely a male disorder also.
There's something else you mentioned in the book, and there was a word, a disease you mentioned, or an affliction you mentioned, and I was going, I haven't heard that word in years, candida. You know, it just strikes me that sometimes the different ways of explaining how we try to explain what's happened to us, it seems they're like trends. It's almost like fashions in a way, you know?
There is a fashion. I mean, there's a fashion, I think, at the moment for allergies. I mean, I've never met so many people in my life who've got allergies. You know, whereas that really wasn't a fashion when I was in medical school. Shortly after I qualified, Candida was a really was being talked about a lot, and it was in the media a lot. And I remember working in the casualty department, and people were coming into me and saying they thought they had Candida. Whereas I haven't seen that now. I have not heard that word spoken to me in, you know, the last 5-10 years. So there's no doubt that there's kind of trends. But I don't think the trends are just attributions. You know, people had the exact same symptoms in 1990 as they have now. But in 1990, they attributed to Candida, and now they attribute it maybe to allergies or different toxins or electrical signals or things like that.
One of the chapters in the book that's got a lot of attention was the chapter on Rachel, the person who was suffering from, or claims she's suffering from ME and chronic fatigue syndrome.
Yeah.
And like I've read a lot from kind of like, I mean, people who, like, I suppose in that who've got that, or whose family who've got someone in their family they think is suffering from that or has been diagnosed with that. What, like, you know, when you look at see that kind of criticism, what's your take on it? I mean, or is this more of people not accepting what it's about?
I mean, very much. I wrote a chapter on fatigue, which is now being interpreted as a chapter on ME. But my point was that as a neurologist, I'm in quite a luxurious position, because if I see someone with seizures, I may form an impression, but then I have very objective tools to prove that my impression is correct. So I'm quite a luxurious position for making this diagnosis. But there are other symptoms that you can only describe and you can't measure. Fatigue and pain are really problematic, because there's absolutely no way of verifying that someone is in pain. They can only tell you about it. So I think those sort of symptoms are particularly difficult to manage and particularly difficult to diagnose. And what I tried to write about in the chapter about a girl who had chronic fatigue syndrome I was really trying to say, just because you can't see it does not mean that it should not be taken as seriously as anything else. And that a symptom such as pain, for example, which can in no way be measured, can be every bit as disabling as something. You know, we kind of need people to be obviously scarred in some way for us to really feel that they are suffering. And really, I was trying to make the point is that we need to take every sort of suffering at face value as it is described to us. Unfortunately, I think that, you know, it is my opinion, and I'm sorry if it offends anybody, but basically that chronic fatigue syndrome has a large psychosomatic component. Now, I speak as someone who feels that psychosomatic illnesses need to be taken seriously. They need to be respected. I managed to get right through medical school and medical training without anyone telling me. I mean, I trained as a neurologist. I saw dozens of people with hysterical seizures before I ever qualified. And I managed to qualify without anyone ever telling me how I was supposed to make people better. So what I'm trying to do is you know, because the model of medicine is, if you're a neurologist, you look after neurological diseases. And once you've ruled out disease, you send that patient away and they're no longer your responsibility. So I've written a book, really, which is trying to say, take all of these things seriously, and we need to develop specialists who look after them in the same way as we have migraine specialists and multiple sclerosis specialists. But unfortunately, merely mentioning psychosomatic disorders are so maligned and looked down on by some groups that even mentioning it in the same paragraph as chronic fatigue syndrome upsets people, unfortunately. I think if we didn't have such a negative view of people who suffer with psychological things, that wouldn't even be necessary. And it shouldn't be necessary, is how I feel about it.
Mm. What was the reaction of your peers to the books, then?
Actually, really good, because, I mean, the thing is that, you know, as a doctor, this is the bread and butter of your work. It doesn't almost matter what sort of doctor you are, a GP, a neurologist, a rheumatologist, a gynecologist. You are going to see at least one third of the people who walk in your door will have a problem which is more likely got sort of a psychological or behavioural cause than a disease cause. And I think that, you know, doctors are finally talking about this. So it was very well received, yeah.
Okay. Look, I mean, you said earlier on, like, you know, you wrote the book, you were writing anyway as a hobby, you know.
Yeah.
Has the fact that, like, I mean, it's won the Wellcome Prize, it's been really well received. Has that kind of encouraged you? Will you write another book about patients? Will you write another book about your practice?
Yeah, I am writing another book, actually. I'm supposed to have it in 4 weeks, but there's absolutely no way that's going to happen. Not a joke. Especially as I'm sitting here all for the whole weekend. Yeah, I'm writing, actually, because a large group of patients I work with are people with epilepsy. Now, probably, like, I always think when I tell people I'm writing a book about epilepsy, they must all just be thinking, oh my God, that sounds terrible. But actually, I mean, epilepsy is unbelievable. And the people who suffer with it are the most kind of uniquely sort of innovative people I've ever met. Just to give you an example, you know, I have this amazing, amazing patient that I work with who's lovely. And she has these kind of seizures. So seizures are not all falling on the ground and shaking. She has these seizures where when she has a seizure, she just runs frenetically for about 1 minute. And basically, she has no idea what she's doing or where she's running. So 1 minute she's on the bus, next minute she's sitting in someone's living room surrounded by a large Bangladeshi family. And basically, she has to then explain to people how she came to run into their house. And, you know, it's just, you know, it's what happens to some of my patients with epilepsy is absolutely unique to them. There won't be another person who has the thing that they have, and therefore they have to find their own kind of unique way around it. And their lives are just incredible. They're very strong, very sort of original people.
Yeah.
So I am. Yeah, my next book is about those people.
Okay. Last question for me, and it's quote I noted from an interview you did. You said it really isn't the problem. The psychosomatic illnesses. It really isn't the problem of doctors and health service only. It's a society wide problem as well. And like, I'm curious about that, because do you think, you know, that we haven't got the wherewithal to actually accept what's going on and to actually try and deal with this in a proper way?
I think that we create the attitude that makes people not want to accept the diagnosis. So I think if we had, you know, two people here, one of whom had sort of were unable to move their legs because they had a car accident, a spinal injury, and you had somebody else who couldn't move their legs because they have a functional psychosomatic disorder, I think that we intrinsically would view those people differently in terms of their disability. Now, it is right to say that one of those people has the potential to get better. But as long as we don't give them the same sort of respect, level of research, level of resources as the other person, then those two people are equally disabled. And I think, unfortunately, you know, if you found out your next door neighbour was having seizures and then you thought it was epilepsy and then you learned it was something else, it was psychological, I think you'd kind of go, oh God, I always thought there was something funny about her or whatever, or something. I think we change our attitudes when we hear this diagnosis. And therefore, How is that neighbour going to be able to feel free to talk about it with other people if they think they're going to be judged? Mm. So I think if we all change our judgments, then people can accept the diagnosis and we can organise resources and research around these people the way we would about any other kind of medical problem.
All right. I said that was the last question. That was the second last question. Last question is actually, there's a trend of kind of physicians and practitioners writing books based on their patients and all that. Mm. What books do you like on that score?
Well, it's absolutely impossible to be a neurologist and not love the work of Oliver Sacks, because, I mean, he was really the kind of neurologist who originally wrote about his patients. And, you know, he writes so beautifully, or he wrote so beautifully. And, you know, he really kind of, he both made neurology interesting for me, but also, you know, he's just such a creative and brilliant writer. So he's amazing.
Okay. Suzanne Sutherland, thank you very much. Big round of applause.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thanks a million to Suzanne for joining us in Dingle. Thanks also to Molly King, who's the producer of Banter at Other Voices. Big thanks to her. Big thanks as well to Tanya White, the Bantercast series producer. We're back next week with another Bantercast. Until then, goodbye, take care, and check out thisisbanter.com for more information on what we're up to.